make sure that when you show up, you walk in there like you own the joint, like you deserve to be there. And that is so important in terms of those first impressions and making sure that you are viewed as a leader.
Hi guys, we're your hosts Jillian
and Kaylin,
and this is Teach Me How to Adult,
a podcast on all the things you never learned growing up, like how to buy a home, manage stress, crush your love life, land your dream job,
and how to love yourself more, because we could all be a little kinder to ourselves.
We're still figuring out how to get our shit together, so we're calling in the experts and the hustlers for some real talk and legit tips on how to live your best life.
Adulting isn't easy, but we got you.
Hi friends, happy new year. I hope everyone is off to a somewhat great start in 2021.
Just surviving even would be great. Surviving. We're working towards thriving. We will get there.
I feel like 2021 is going to be the year when a lot of people just stop taking shit, you know?
100%. Everyone is like, there's no more fucks to give. There's going to be clear boundaries drawn. And people, I really feel like, are just at the point where it's like, you might as well just fucking ask for what you want.
Yeah, because we've all had a dumpster fire of a year in 2020. And we just don't need that for this year. So
no.
If any of you do need a little help asking for what you want, we have you covered. And we are so excited for this episode because we are talking all things negotiation.
After listening to this, you are going to confidently be able to go after the things you want in life, because we called in negotiation expert Fatini Iconomopoulos. So a lot of us don't even realize that we're all actually negotiating every day. Basically, anytime you want someone to say yes to something or to agree with you, you are entering a negotiation. Yep. So whether that's a raise or just buying a product and trying to get the salesperson to meet you halfway, or straight up just ordering in from your favorite restaurant, not your friends, yes, not your partners, all of these situations, you are in a negotiation, especially if you're trying to get a kid to eat some broccoli. That's like the ultimate test.
It's so true. And it's so key for young people and especially women, since according to a recent Harvard Business Review study, 20% of women don't negotiate at all.
Which is kind of brutal. And there was also a study like years ago, so I'm sure it's changed since then, but they said that 7% of women would attempt a first salary negotiation, and that's it. Only 7%. What?
That's insane. I mean, I've been there.
Yeah. I've been now in the workforce for 8 years.
Yeah.
And I think I've only truly negotiated in the past year. So the struggle's real.
And it's hard because it may not seem like a big number when you're starting out and you're trying to negotiate that first salary. But mm-hmm. According to the same article, the average woman that doesn't negotiate their salary will forego an average of $7,000 US in their first year of work. But compounded, you're going to lose between $650,000 and $1 million over the course of your 45-year career.
That is mind-blowing.
$1 million!
Literally, the compound effect of feeling like we are not good enough to ask for more can be $1 million. We are literally leaving money on the table. But I know that it's easier said than done. And it's really, really hard when you're young and you're starting out, because you feel so grateful to just have a job, especially when you're in the creative industry, especially if you are a minority group. There's a lot of factors that can really hold people back. I know for me, starting off in the creative industry, a lot of it was just learning to be able to acknowledge my own worth and what I could bring to the table, and really facing my fear of hearing no, because there's some industries that will convince you that you are just lucky to be employed and you should take whatever shit is thrown at you and be grateful for it, and then work your ass off like you're being paid $100,000 a year, which you're not when you start off.
Right.
And 2020 was truly the first year of my life that I genuinely, like deep within me, felt I deserve more, and I know it, and I'm just going to ask for it. And if someone says we can't afford that, then I guess this isn't where I'm going to work or what I'm going to be doing, and I'll find a place that can. It's not a poor reflection on you or who you are. And chances are they probably, if they really want you, will find the money. They will find the money and they will make it work.
Or they'll meet you close to what you ask for if they can. Like they'll throw you a bone, hopefully.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not like you ever really go in asking for exactly what you want, because you have to understand they're probably going to counter offer with something less. And so you want to give yourself a bit of buffer and you'll find yourself closer to the middle. And we've talked about this before, but there's lots of things that you can negotiate in an interview. Mm-hmm. beyond just salary. So
keep that in mind for sure. I actually turned down my very first job offer because they wouldn't hit. I just needed to hit this like specific range to know that I would like survive in Toronto and not be eating craft dinner every night. Although Katie is delish. Let's be real.
Oh, put some boursin in it. Oh, so good.
So good. Well, I'm a ketchup Katie girl. I don't know about you. Ooh. I know. I'm going to lose a lot of friends from that, but
I still love you.
Anyways, when I turned it down, they actually ended up counter offering with the salary that I wanted. And I think it was only like maybe $1,000 or $2,000 that we were negotiating over. And it was risky, but I'm so glad that I did that because I think that compound effect and even just the confidence of asking for what I wanted served me so well in my other job. So don't be scared.
Good for you. I also really appreciate that the biggest thing I've learned in researching negotiation recently is it actually doesn't need to be about bulldozing other people over so that mm-hmm. you can get what you want. Whether you're negotiating with your family or friends or partner or in a career workplace environment, it's ideally a collaboration that helps both parties get what they want. So it's ultimately all about channeling confidence, clear communication, listening, and empathy. And when you break it down like that, a lot of us already have those skills. We just need to apply them. Because I automatically, when we started talking about this episode, it was like, oh, I'm not a very good negotiator. Like, Kaylin's really good, and like, Kaylin's husband is really good at negotiating, but I'm pretty shit. And then the more I learned about it, I'm like, well, I'm a great communicator. I'm very empathetic. I always try to understand where other people are coming from. Mm-hmm. I have all the tools. I just need to apply them and know that if I can help the other side find some benefit that mm-hmm. also benefits me, we have had a successful negotiation.
Yeah. And imagine how different our lives could be if we weren't afraid to ask for what we deserved. So before we get into our interview with Fatini, we just wanted to touch on three quick and dirty ways that you can brush up on your negotiation skills in your everyday life.
This one's pretty easy. You're going to want to educate yourself. There are so many great resources, books, podcasts, experts like Fatini who offer advice on social media. All of these resources can help you become a super confident negotiator. And as soon as you start reading up on it and start applying it, like, you'll feel your confidence increase and you'll feel your communication skills get better.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, you will impress yourself because I already have. Kaylin and I took Chris Voss's masterclass on negotiation and it was such a game changer.
It's so good.
If you guys don't know Chris Voss, he spent 24 years in the FBI as a lead hostage negotiator. No big deal. And he successfully released hostages who were kidnapped by criminals and terrorists. So definitely knows his stuff.
He is the man. And he actually just put out a book actually a couple years ago. It's called Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. And it's also really good.
LinkedIn also has a negotiation skills course for beginners for $40 or for free if you have LinkedIn Premium. And there's tons of local universities and colleges that offer continued education courses on negotiation. And they do that because it is so applicable to any job that you have, whether you are in sales or whether you're just a graphic designer who's trying to negotiate what their freelance rate is. It's applicable no matter what you do.
Yeah. So another thing that you can do is practice some pro negotiation strategies. And two of them, which Jill naturally does, and we kind of learned this when we took Chris Voss's course, but it's called mirroring and labeling. So walk us through it because you're so good at this.
Thanks, man. Well, mirroring is really just listening on steroids. It is the repetition of key words that the person you're negotiating with uses in conversation. It can sound manipulative, but what it really is making the other person feel heard and like you're not just waiting with what your reply is going to be. That's a mistake that a lot of people make in communication. They just jump in at the first chance with what their retort or response is rather than making the other person feel heard. So by repeating their words, it shows that you're actively listening, you're understanding them, you're building trust. And it's super helpful for diffusing a situation if you can tell the other person is getting heated. So if I were to say, I'm feeling overwhelmed and I don't think that you understand the amount of pressure and stress that I'm under, Kaylin might say,
pressure and stress?
And then that would make me feel like, okay, she's trying to understand me. She's listening. She legit cares what I'm going through. And I'd be like, yeah, I'm feeling a lot of pressure and stress to get this episode out, Kaylin. I need you to work with me.
And then I'm like, tell me more. And then basically it just makes Jill give me more information that I could use in my negotiation with her. It's not manipulative to your point. It's just building that trust between us.
It's information gathering because the most important thing you can do in any communication or negotiation is gather information.
Yep. And then with labeling, which you're also very good at, it's essentially just verbally acknowledging the other person's feeling or stance on something. So it might sound like Jill saying, Kaylin, it seems like you're really stressed or you're under a lot of pressure. or it feels like you're getting really frustrated. So that kind of verbiage can help diffuse the situation too. If I'm getting really heated, her saying those words can sort of calm me down, make me feel understood, make it seem like we're on the same like emotional playing field. It's super helpful.
A good negotiation should be about helping the other person feel calm and understood and leveling out and ending up in the same emotional place so that mm-hmm. you can have like a really good productive conversation. Another way that you can do that that's really beneficial is using positive reinforcement, and that can really yield a more generous negotiation. So I've got a lot of people in my life that I've watched talk to an airline service or any sort of customer service situation mm-hmm. and where a lot of us go in pretty hot and pretty upset and we're yeah. just like, I'm not happy with this and this has happened. If you go in, you ask the person their name, you form a connection and a bond with them, and you're just like, you know what, Susan, I bet you've had so many rough calls today. Thank you for taking the time. I know that you are trying to help me find a solution, and I appreciate that. You are giving them positive reinforcement to help you get the result that you want, and they feel like you're on the same side. So try to like pull away from our natural inclination to be kind of aggressive when we're trying to get what we want, and use positive reinforcement and these like positive labeling strategies to get people to want you to win.
That's a really good point. I think kindness goes a long way. So the next one is selling or buying items on Kijiji or Facebook Marketplace. Practice negotiating with the buyer. We just moved into a bigger space and we needed a lot more furniture, but we're on a tight budget. So we leaned on Kijiji and got some awesome new items. And it was literally the biggest crash course I've ever had in negotiation. And the best part is it's not really awkward because it's faceless. Like, I don't know these people. They don't know me. It's super low stakes. You don't have any skin in the game. So you can be a little bit more confident and fearless negotiating. And I mean, it's only like $50 here and there, you know, it's not negotiating your salary or a bonus. So it's a really good way to dip your toe into negotiation if you're like fresh.
But we are not the experts. So we called in Futini Iconomopoulos, who has been helping people get what they deserve for decades. Her book, keynotes, workshops, and virtual courses are all designed to teach negotiation and communication skills.
And Futini is an MBA negotiation professor at the Schulich School of Business. So cool. She's done tons of media appearances. And in April 2021, she's going to be releasing her first book, Say Less, Get More, Unconventional Negotiation Techniques to Get What You Want. So stay tuned for that.
I can't wait to read that. Teach us how to negotiate with confidence, Futini.
Thank you so much, Futini, for taking the time to chat with us today. We are so excited about this topic. It is very important and something that people will need to use for pretty much everything in their lives.
A lot of us think of negotiations in terms of big moments, like accepting a job offer or asking for a raise or negotiating the down payment on your first home. But what are some examples of how negotiations come up every day in small ways throughout our lives?
Yeah, we negotiate more often than we realize. So people think about those big moments in life, but what about the moment where you're sitting across the table from a relative and you don't want to throat punch them? Or you have to have a conversation with your partner about where you're going to go on vacation or how you're going to handle a difficult conversation with your manager about, you know, somebody else around you who's not wearing a mask at work. These are all things, these are all moments, potential opportunities for conflict or potential opportunities for value creation for both parties. So we are facing these things every single day. Anybody who has children knows that you are negotiating 24/7 if you spend time around kids. I don't have kids of my own, but it's because they're going, well, I don't have anything to lose, so why not ask for something, right? They're constantly trying to test boundaries. And every single one of those interactions is also a negotiation. It's not just about monetary gain. It's about how do I create peace and harmony? How do I reduce my stress? And every time you're up against one of those moments where it could turn into stress, that's a negotiation.
Right. That's a great point. And that's so well put that children don't seem to have that fear of testing boundaries. And then as we age, we become a bit more anxious about testing those boundaries.
Yeah, I mean, it's because we have egos. As an adult, our egos develop in a different way. And I would say even in children, I would say little girls start to shy away from those negotiation opportunities more quickly than little boys do, because we are almost told you don't want to look stupid. You don't want to look silly. You don't want to look foolish. So that's one of the contributing factors that made women so much less likely to negotiate on their own behalf, to advocate on their own behalf. So that's why we have a gender gap. Today, that's changing. But generally speaking, one of the reasons we don't speak up for ourselves as a general audience and for adults is we're worried about looking stupid. Kids aren't worried about their ego. So like, what's the worst that's going to happen? I'm going to get sent to my room and I have to play with my new games that I just got for Christmas. Big deal. That's they don't have that fear of their ego in the back of their minds.
So what is it that you think holds women especially back from negotiating with that ego? Is it like, is it our imposter syndrome? Is it our just fear of getting rejected or hearing no or being unlikable or difficult? Like, what do you think in your experience?
It's all of the above, but it's a legitimate fear of being treated differently. Study after study shows us that women are treated differently in negotiation. They're not just treated differently by men. We're also treated differently by our fellow women. So when you know somebody in your network, or you know of somebody, or you've heard a story, or you've seen it in a movie, or you've seen it at a subconscious level, that you are that your gender is going to be treated differently than the others, there's a reason why we're holding back. Most of the time, I would say people can't articulate it. They don't realize that it happens at such a subconscious level. But there's this legitimate fear of, what if? And the number one thing they say to me is, what if they rescind the offer? What if they take it away? And that's a legitimate fear. It's unlikely, statistically, there's a very low risk of it. When you handle it effectively, there's a very low risk of it. But not a lot of people are familiar with what effective looks like, because we also don't have a lot of female role models doing those things. We are punished because we need to be liked more than men do. There is I kind of use the analogy of, imagine a balance beam that gymnasts work on, right? So the gymnast can work on one that's just a few inches wide, or, you know, people who are not coming from a minority group are working on one that's 2 feet wide, and it's changing, but it's changing at such a slow, slow pace.
Right. That's really helpful to know, because I've been thinking for a while, looking back at the fact that I never up until this year negotiated my salary. But the borderline anxiety attack I had asking for what I thought I deserved was insane, because I knew it was above the industry standard. And I knew, being in a creative industry, things are tight right now. And I was like, oh my God, how can I be asking for more when I know people are just struggling to stay employed? And so I just wanted to get to the root of what was causing me to have so much anxiety about that. If it was the fear of hearing no, or the fear of sounding like ridiculous.
No, I mean, everything you're saying is so common. And especially when I'm talking to people like students who are coming to me and they're going, but what if they just take the offer and they go to the next person on the list? And I have to tell them, hey, why are they talking to you? Why are they talking to you in the first place? If you are a creative, they've come to you instead of to somebody else. In certain worlds, you get what you pay for, right? Because it's a subjective thing. There's no objective. This is the best, you know, it's not a magic formula in that creative space either. So you, if you're not advocating for yourself and you're not expressing your value, how are they going to know how valuable you are? Now, the challenge is how you do it. How do you do it in such a way that isn't going to be perceived as arrogant, greedy, all of those things? Because it's that tightrope, like it's that balance beam that I mentioned. What I tell people is, yes, you have a legitimate fear, but you need to talk about your worth. You need to find a way to be more boastful without sounding boastful. And so there's some techniques that you can use to do that are more subtle than hitting them between the eyes with, I'm the best in the business. That might be perceived as arrogant. It might not in some circles. I'm not going to say whether it's right or wrong, because it depends on your circumstances. But there might be a way to talk about your achievements and what makes you different and so on, as opposed to, you know, different might be better than best. You know, having listened to you, here are some of the things where I think I can help your business, where we can work together to achieve the greatest results. Here's where some of my skills will complement your skills.
And jumping on the techniques, are there some examples of effective language that people can use in a negotiation, or phrases to just avoid altogether?
One of the easiest techniques that I keep coming back to is asking questions. So instead of telling somebody, for example, that's never going to work, how about you say something like, what do you think the client would think about that? Or how do you think so-and-so would respond to that? you know, there's all these ways that you can go into tell mode or you can go to ask mode. What about that is difficult for you? If someone is in a job offer situation and we can't do that right now, okay, when is the right time for us to have the conversation? What is it that you're looking for specifically? When you get them talking, mm-hmm. they're giving away loads of information. And so information is power. I think we can all agree on that. So they could give you all the ammunition you need in order to build your case later if you need to, or you can get them talking about themselves so that they think it's their idea instead of yours, right? So when you Brilliant. Say something like, what do you think the client would say about that? They're going to go, oh, right. That's a terrible idea. Instead of you going, that's awful. Shut it down right now. There's lots of ways to manage around those, but questions is one of the easiest ways to do that. Questions are also a really great way of managing that likability factor, because you're not seen as aggressive, abrasive, bitchy, and so on. So you're asking how or what type questions are going to get the conversation going instead of shutting it down. So, because I'm not suggesting yes or no questions. If you ask somebody a no question, they're likely going to give you a no. And so you don't want to just close it. You want to find a way to open up the conversation and expand on, tell me a little bit more about that. What is it about that is challenging for you? How can I help in these things? And whenever I'm going into a negotiation of any kind with a new client, for example, or I'm talking to somebody about their upcoming conference and that I'm going to be a speaker at, I get them to start talking first. Tell me a little bit about your company. Tell me a little bit about the challenges that you face, so that when it's time for me to share what I do and how I do it, then I can go, that thing that you said earlier, here's how I can help with that. Or I heard you say this thing, and that's something that's really important to me as well. So if you can get them doing some talking, now you get to use their own words in your pitch or in your proposal or whatever it is. And it's very hard for them to say no, because it's a great little boost to their ego. In the back of their minds, they're going, oh, those words are familiar. That's something that I want to be doing. Those are the things that you want to be thinking about. It's a much more collaborative approach, but not in a, I'm giving you all the power. It's collaborative in that I'm still in control of this conversation. I'm just going to do it in a way that is going to be less abrasive.
That's really smart.
Brilliant.
Funny enough, it almost reminds me of therapy in that a lot of questions are asked that help lead you to the answer that the therapist might already have or they already might know about, but they want you to get there. They're not going to spoon feed you. Like they're going to keep leading you with questions and allow you to kind of unravel everything and then arrive at the same place. So it's used in many applications. Questions are really powerful. And is there anything that people should avoid?
You mean any questions specifically or any general techniques?
General language that is best to avoid in a negotiation.
Yeah, I would say generally it's avoiding threatening language. So there is a time and a place for threats. It is rare circumstances where I recommend people go there. Threats should be a last resort. If you don't do this, you're going to end up doing this. Even with children, if you don't clean that up, you're going to be cut off. You're going to be grounded for 3 weeks. First of all, unless you're going to actually follow through on those 3 weeks, you are losing all credibility. It's gone, and forget any future negotiations being easy for you. Second of all, that is like fighting fire with fire. So when people get really abrasive, we are tempted at a subconscious level. We're tribal people. We are going back to our caveman and cavewoman days. We want to be liked by others, and we mirror each other's behavior. That's our natural instinct. And so when you raise your voice, I'm tempted to raise my voice too. That is not the answer. If you can do the opposite and you can be the mirror that you want them to follow. So for example, if someone starts to raise their voice, you want to make the effort to keep your voice calm and slow and take deep breaths, because when you slow down your breath at a subconscious level, they're going to pick up on it and do the same thing. But if you'd say to somebody, calm down, it doesn't work. No one in the history of people has ever calmed down as a result of someone saying calm down.
Never. So I can attest to that.
Yeah. So you want to use your emotions in a productive way, as opposed to being abused by your emotions. So I would say that's a really big one. Be careful of going into that tell mode. Be careful of ushering or uttering threats, because I feel like those can get really dangerous and they can get really dry, and you become the boy that cried wolf if you are not following through on them. I always feel like there's a lot of other techniques to use before you go down that path. Being mindful of that type of language Very public negotiators have humiliated themselves and have lost all credibility in the political world when they issue those types of threats, and now no one believes a word that comes out of their mouths. So it's being mindful of those role models that we can learn a thing or two from in terms of don't do that, as well as the people that we can learn from in the do that.
And can you talk to us a bit about the importance of using pauses in a negotiation and like allowing room for silence?
Yeah, absolutely. So when people get nervous, what happens when you are stressed is you go back to your caveman, cavewoman instincts. You have a physiological response to stress. Your heart starts to race a little bit faster. Your lungs start to take more shallow breaths. And all basically the energy leaves your brain and goes to your limbs. And that's what allows you to run like hell to get away from the saber-toothed tiger of our caveman and cavewoman predecessors. Even though we don't have those same physical threats, we have psychological threats. And so our bodies do exactly the same thing. So when that happens, we are tempted to just think and talk at the same time. And when that happens, it's a recipe for disaster. And so pausing has a couple of different effects. One, if you can just pause and take a breath, you will prevent yourself from that verbal diarrhea that will inevitably cause you more pain later. You'll prevent those moments that make you go, oh God, why did I do that? Why did I say that? This is what I should have said. Right? Everybody has those moments where they walk away and go, oh, why didn't I think of that at the moment? Because your brain was on overdrive. That's what's expected. So give it a chance to slow down. Pause so that you allow that rational thought to come back into your brain, first of all. So it gives you an opportunity to reframe things, to remind yourself of something that you practice, to think of your positive mantra, to take a calming breath, whatever it's going to take to bring you back into the rational zone that you need in order to function properly. There's a reason why my book title is Say Less, Get More. That say less is trivial to make sure that you don't talk yourself out of a deal and that you give everybody in the room enough space to actually get the information you need that's going to help you to close the deal. If you were to pause and go, that's an interesting question. Give me a second to think about that. I would think, oh, wow, that is a considered person. That is a credible response to make sure they're not going to say something stupid, that they're actually going to be considering all of the things that are important to me. Maybe they're even acknowledging me, and now I feel like I can trust them. There is so much good that happens when you take that pause. You're creating space for the others to give you information. You're creating space in your own brain, and you're actually looking far more confident than you would be if you were thinking and talking at the same time.
Right. If you were in an interview setting, do you think it's okay for a candidate to just be like, let me think about that for a second, and literally say that out loud if you need to just address the pause? Or do you think you just literally keep it quiet and don't talk until you can figure it out?
Well, I think it can be super awkward if you keep it quiet for too long, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to go, did you hear me? What's happening? Yeah. Especially if this is something on the phone or on video of some kind in this day and age. You become that person in the phone commercial that goes, can you hear me? Can you hear me now? So I think sometimes it's appropriate to frame that pause and go, I need a moment to think about that. I need a moment. I want to make sure I give you the most accurate response I can. Or I want to make sure I give you something that's going to be relevant for you right now. Now you've just reframed it for me, and you look like you're in charge because you're taking your time, right? You own the clock in that room. You're not feeling rushed. You're not nervous. You're not eager. But also, you've reframed it for me and treated it as a gift for me, that you're not going to waste my time with some stupid answer, off-the-cuff response. So I do think it's beneficial in most cases to frame it if it's going to be a very long pause.
Yeah, and that exudes so much confidence too, because I think we feel very rushed sometimes because we don't want to take up too much time and we just power through. But when you, as you said, kind of own the clock in that room and take that pause and allow yourself the time to put together a great answer, it to me comes off as a very powerful, confident move.
Yeah, and that's so surprising to most people because I do so much training, and even now in the virtual space, I'm training people, and we do, I film people. So I make them negotiate with each other and we record it and we watch it back. And you can see the difference with the people when I give them a time pressure, like I say, there's 1 minute left. It's like all of a sudden everybody speeds up their language and starts talking over each other and they both look terrible. And then you see a video where someone's sitting there quietly and they look so confident, and everybody else in the room goes, wow, that looks super confident. The person who was quiet goes, oh my God, I was so nervous. I was ready to fall apart. But it doesn't look that way in the video. Yeah. It can be a million things going on inside your brain, but you can project something quite different if you just take that minute of pause and poise to exhibit that to somebody else.
Interesting. So on that, I wonder, how much does body language play a part in negotiation then too, especially maybe even in those pauses? Is there anything you can like look out for in the person that you're negotiating with?
When somebody is smiling at me and they're smiling with their eyes and we see what's called the Dufresne smile, which means like wrinkles around your eyes and your mouth, then I can tell it's a genuine smile versus that fake smile that most people have in all photos. My mom and I are famous for the fake smile at Christmas. You know, those are the things that we look for. You want to, your body language can also project a lot. So if you are hunched in front of your computer all the time, and I read recently that children these days are actually growing horns on the back of their skulls because their heads are looking down so much at screens. Yeah, scary what? Stuff.
I think I have
your,
that.
Your jaws just dropped for good reason.
Oh my gosh. We're raising devil children.
But that says to me, you know, if you're hunched over and you're not taking up much physical space, I would potentially read into that and go, this person seems uncomfortable, weak, not very confident. That might not be the case at all, but that is a perception that I'm going to go with because perception becomes reality for the other person versus standing up straight, your shoulders nice and wide. When you think about how men stand in a room versus women, you know, we take up often less space. I tell people, take up your space in the room. Be in charge of that room. Spread your stuff out on the table so you're not cramped. I saw a picture of Theresa May recently before she resigned as the leader over in the UK. And she was sitting on a bench in Parliament where, you know, they're all kind of crammed. They're not separate seats, but they're all crammed there. Yeah. And she's the leader of this freaking part of the world. And she's cramped because these guys in suits are literally taking over her physical space. That is not somebody I'm going to look at and go, I'm going to have faith in the decisions that this person makes. You know, she might have been amazing at her job, but it's not a perception that we feel like we want to follow. So there is a body language issue in terms of what you project, but there's also the element of what you read back. So I tell people, you know, Dr. Amy Cuddy did a great TED talk on something called, I think, Your Body Language Can Shape Who You Are. She also wrote a phenomenal book about it called Presence. And she talks about how you show up. And she talks about power poses and all of these things, like the Wonder Woman pose with your hands on your hips and the victor, which is like your hands go in the air the second you want to cross the finish line if you've ever run a marathon or something like that. These are times when we feel really powerful. And those are the images that we have in our mind of what is powerful. So present those images to the other party. And her research shows your brain will catch up. Right? Where versus if you are taking up less space in the room, you know, the blood's not flowing, you're probably not functioning at full capacity. This is where I tell people, you know, take that advice, heed that advice, and fake it until you become it. You know, it's not just fake it till you make it, fake it until you become it. So you want to project all of that really lovely body language to say, hey, I'm here, I deserve to be here, I know what I'm doing. You know, I'm only 5'5". I don't take up a lot of physical space in the room. So I'm going to do my damnedest to, you know, collarbone nice and wide, sitting nice and tall and so on. If I'm hunched over, I look weak. If my ex-boss, who is like 6'5", was leaning over, he might look menacing to somebody, right? That can be a very different vibe. So it all depends on the context as well. And that's the really important thing for body language. Even when I'm talking to children, do I want to be looking down at them, towering over them? In some cases where I want to be the authority figure that they're not going to push back on, probably. If I want to reason with them or relate to them, I'm going to crouch down and be at eye level with them. So there's all of these things that we can take into account that will help us either be more authoritative or appear more authoritative or appear more collaborative. You know, when you're sitting with somebody in a boardroom, are you sitting directly across from them adversarially in a power position? Are you sitting perpendicular to them, so that you are with them at the table instead of against them at the table? You know, if you're going on a first date, I trained a bunch of matchmakers and we talk about body language to them too. If you're sitting on a first date, don't sit across from somebody, sit next to somebody because it's going to be a much more comfortable environment, right? So there's a different body language vibe that you're putting out there. It's less formal and so on. There's so many things that we can take into account. And I would say one specific piece of advice I have for women when it comes to this is I ask women's groups whenever I'm speaking to them in the conferences, think about when you walk into a room, and let's say it's a traditional boardroom style or it's a classroom style, where do you sit in that room? Because too often, women don't go to the front of the room. They'll go, oh, I'm not senior enough, so I'll leave this seat, this prime seat, for somebody else. I'll just sit along the chairs against the back of the wall. You are now already putting yourself at a disadvantage, because that in itself is a negotiation. How am I going to negotiate with you for you to follow me and my ideas if I'm way back in the back of the room where you can't even see me? That has never been my style. I always sit in the front of the room, because if I have a question and there's a dude who's 6'5" sitting in front of me, I could be waving my hand back and forth and you're not going to see anything. But if I'm sitting at the front of the room, you are going to notice me. So if you want to be noticed, make sure that you show up like you deserve that seat. And people will say to me, but what if the CEO shows up and then they don't have a seat? What's the right thing to do? If you are in that prime seat, or, you know, I'm not suggesting you take the seat at the head of the table. Maybe you take seat number two. But let's say all those other seats are now gone and CEO walks in. You are now in a position where you have something to offer that person. You are now in a position where you go, hey, I showed up early today. You need this seat more than I do. I'll give it to you next time. Next time somebody else can give up their seat. It's cool. You are now in a position where they owe you something. But if you were the person who gave up that seat hoping that it would go to that person in the first place because you were sitting in the back of the room somewhere, they never knew that you showed up on time. They never recognized you. They never had a chance to make eye contact with you. So make sure that when you show up, you walk in there like you own the joint, like you deserve to be there. And that is so important in terms of those first impressions and making sure that you are viewed as a leader.
It actually reminds me of my first day at Disney. We had a big marketing meeting and I went in the boardroom, sat right at the head, not thinking at all. And then our VP walked in and he was like, oh, you took my spot. And I was like, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry. But it was a great icebreaker. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that set the tone for me with the team. I mean, probably shouldn't have sat at the head, like, looking back at it now. But you know what? It's all good. But I went for it.
But the point is to be strategic about it instead of being passive about it and just giving that opportunity to somebody else. And, you know, if you want to be in someone's line of sight, do you want to be the one sitting right next to them or do you want to be sitting somewhere diagonal so you can make eye contact? Mm-hmm. All of those things can help you move a conversation forward. It just, I'm telling people, be strategic about it instead of feeling like you're not valued in that space.
What role does emotional intelligence play in negotiation? And how does gaining understanding and empathy for the other side help you get what you ultimately want?
Oh, it's the primary focus. It's the reason why I still have a job and AI hasn't taken over. I tell people all the time, you know, negotiations are not won on spreadsheets because we are not rational creatures. We are ruled by our emotions. And so if you don't have some emotional intelligence and you have no idea what's going on in the room, you are not going to get anywhere. You can give them all of the math and all of the rational statistics and all those things until the cows come home. But if their emotions are not matching that, if you have triggered their ego, people will cut their nose to spite their face. And so absolutely, it is imperative that you have some emotional intelligence when you're going into something. It's imperative that you're picking up on the cues, like they went quiet all of a sudden, or they're not sharing as much, or their language is quite charged. You know, all of those things are things that the clues that you need to pick up on outside of the numbers that are going to be going back and forth, right? How pissed off are they? How collaborative are they? How trustworthy are they? Those are all emotional cues that we are giving and receiving people all the time. The numbers are the easiest part, but it's that language and when what am I saying that's triggering their emotions, their egos, or what am I doing that's calming all of those things? So absolutely, it is imperative that you factor that into things. It's not just about memorizing a script and going in there, because people will say to me, you need to be confident because no matter what I tell you to say in that moment, if you don't believe it yourself, if you don't believe in your value, it's going to come out a jumbled mess and you're going to fall on your face. and they're not going to believe it, right? If you don't sound like you believe it, then they're not going to believe you. They're not going to have any trust in what you're saying. And the other thing too is I can say, okay, based on my knowledge of your situation, here are some things that I want you to consider, but you know the people better than I do. You have spent time in that room. You know some of their boundaries. You know some of their hot buttons. I can deduce a lot in when I start questioning and when I start spotting patterns of behavior. And so I can start to give even more specific guidelines for people. But ultimately I say, you're the one who's in that room seeing the signals that I can't. So what is it that you're picking up on?
And the genuine attempt to understand what the other side wants too, and not just pushing your own agenda, which I'm sure you're asking all the questions ultimately helps with. Because I feel like people in sales are so good at that already. They know we have to go in, understand what the other side wants, and then we have to try to solve it.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. So people assume that the best salespeople are the ones who are the fast talking types, like the ones that you see in the movies. And I've been in the room. Yeah, I've been in the room with those people. They're not the best salespeople. That is very short term. I've been in the room. I told a story recently where I went into a sales pitch with a new client with a colleague. So I was asked to come and join this meeting because I was the Canadian person on the ground. So my American colleague came into this meeting with a potential new Canadian client, and he started going into his pitch. He went into pitch mode and he started telling all the benefits and all the things that we do. And I could see the look on the face of the woman sitting across from him to the point where I could see her disengaging. I could see her opening her mouth as if she wanted to say something, and he kept steamrolling over her. And I was like, this is not going well. And it got to the point where I kind of tapped his foot with my foot, because I was sitting next to him, to shut him up, because I needed to interject and go, tell me a little bit more about what that's like at your culture, in your organization, because she wasn't feeling heard. You can't just shove your opinions, your views, your numbers, your proposals down the other person's throat. You need to take into account what is valuable to them. And you need to give that space for them to feel like it's a conversation. You have to work with them and not against them.
Yeah, I feel like there's a fine line between being assertive versus being aggressive during a negotiation.
Yeah.
So how do you navigate that with your clients?
Yeah, so there's kind of two techniques. One is what I talked about earlier, is asking questions, right? So you can be in inquisitive, curious mode instead of tell mode. Right? So you're still being assertive in that you are raising these subject areas. I'm not being aggressive by telling you this is the only way and this is how it must work. It's going, have you thought about doing it this way, right? That's an assertive approach without being aggressive. The other thing that you can do is to be more assertive is watch your language. So we tend to use soft language. We tend to use language that takes away from our messaging and makes us less assertive. So I think it's probably going to be somewhere around $1,000. All of those extra words need to go. The price is $1,000. For a project like this is $1,000. Those words are going to sound much more assertive and much more firm than I think it's probably somewhere around in the range of maybe probably actually all of these other words that we use because we're so uncomfortable. So let me think and talk at the same time. Take a pause, cut out all that extra language, and then you'll be able to be more firm. And you won't go to the other extreme of being aggressive. You're going to have to pay this much if you want me to do those things. Right? So right. That's, again, say less, get more. Forget all that extra language. Just keep it succinct. Keep it tight. And you will be plenty assertive without being aggressive. Aggressive is I'm being too emotional about it. I'm being threatening about it. I'm being demanding about it. So you want to be really careful of that, especially for women. Again, men are forgiven for being aggressive. Women generally aren't.
And do you have any specific tips for how during these COVID times and a bit of a unknown economic landscape in 2021, how can employees go about asking for a raise, or if they're starting a new job, a higher salary when everything is so unstable right now?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say the advice isn't dramatically different than it is what it is in normal times, because context is everything all the time. The context has changed slightly now, but even within an organization, I had somebody approach me this summer asking for advice, a former student who said, I'm at one of the big four consulting firms. They laid off a ton of people. People took pay cuts, but my department is thriving. My department is covering the profitability for all these other departments that are doing really poorly. And if it wasn't for me, this department wouldn't be thriving right now. Why shouldn't that person be rewarded? There is always exceptions for that kind of thing. If they say, hey, look, COVID policy is we are on a hiring freeze, or we are on salary freezes or promotions and things like that. Then I tell people, you're still going to go about the negotiation process. You just need to think about the horizon, the length of this negotiation being a little bit longer. So they say, we can't right now because of these policies and so on. Okay, when? What do you need to see? When is it going to be a good time for us to do this? What milestones do we need to hit? Is it when a vaccine comes? Is it when our company hits such and such numbers? Is it when the company-wide policy is lifted? What are the markers for that? Get really specific instead of them allowing them to say, not right now. Okay, well, when? What is a good time for us to have a follow-up conversation about this? What are some of the things that need to be accomplished in order for this to become a reality? How can we go about that? Again, it's about asking lots of questions to manage that. Mm-hmm. Know the context. Some people, though, are not at all affected by COVID. Some are just doing really well. Some companies are doing great. And so why should you change anything in this time? You shouldn't feel guilty if your company's doing well, if you're exceeding performances and so on. You should not be shying away just because some other people are having challenges. Why should that stop you? So it's about being cognizant of your specific context and being somewhat compassionate for that, but then going, okay, that is true. Yes, we are falling on hard times right now. Hard times won't last forever. What do we need to do to get out of this? How do we expedite that a little bit faster? And if you're getting wishy-washy responses at some point, that might be your clue to go, all right, maybe then it's time for me to make a move. Though I will say people are less likely to make moves these days because of the economic uncertainty. I don't want to leave my stable job, even if I'm unhappy in it, to go to something that might, you know, I have 3 months probation and I might lose my job. Just like that, mm-hmm. right? I don't know what I'm going into. So I understand that. But just if you do have an opportunity in front of you, treat it the way you would any other negotiation situation. Do your research. How is the company doing right now? How many other people? What's going on in the market? I am hearing stories of companies who are in distress, who are doing the layoffs and all that kind of stuff, but they're bringing in my MBA students and paying them more than the people who have now gotten those pay cuts, because they go, we need to also be thinking about the future. We don't want to lose great candidates. Mm-hmm. So don't assume just because that in general, the population has fallen on hard times, that your situation is indicative of all of those situations. Look at your situation specifically, but also look at it with that element of compassion, knowing that not every boss, not every company, not every team is going to be going through that. But that's part of doing your research, which is, you know, standard operating procedure when it comes to any type of negotiation, let alone negotiating in COVID. The other thing too to be mindful of is right now, if you're in a company where they have been scaling back and they have been laying people off, or maybe we're not bringing in external people and so on, if you are doing more work than you were doing before, and you deserve to get paid more for doing that. If they don't have the budget for that, fine, I understand. But at least raise the question and go, hey, if we're saving money on all these things, what can we do about compensating me for all of this extra time and energy that I'm putting in? So ask that question, because it might be cheaper to give you a salary increase if they're cutting all these other people than losing you and bringing in somebody who isn't capable of handling all of this extra stuff that you're doing. And training somebody right now would be a nightmare. But that's where I go into one of the watchouts that I said earlier. Don't start going in threatening either, saying, if you don't give me an increase because I'm doing all these extra hours, I'm going to leave. That's dangerous territory. That's just like poking the bear and triggering somebody's egos. But have those conversations. And if they say we can't right now, have some compassion, but ask the question to make sure that they have some compassion for you too, to go, at some point, this is going to have to end. How do we see the writing on the wall to know when that time comes? I need to see some light at the end of the tunnel. Walk me through what that could look like. What is the future going to look like here? Right? So it's looking at it from both perspectives that I think is going to be really important.
Yeah, and asking those probing questions too, I mean, in my opinion, I feel like it would prove to your employer that you're serious and you want to stay and you want to know how you can get to the next level. So instead of just hearing no and just taking that and maybe being bitter or quitting, asking those questions gives you so much insight to what's possible with your future at the company.
That's totally. So key. Yeah. And it is perceived as a collaborative problem-solving approach as opposed to a complaining approach. You know, when I coach my MBA students in their job interviews, I tell them, talk to them about what are your future plans. I see myself staying here for a really long time. What does that trajectory look like? You know, I know you're not going to make me any promises about promotions in 6 months, 12 months, whatever, but you know, I see myself staying here for a long time. So what could this potentially look like? Let's talk a little bit more about opportunities, the future, and all of that kind of stuff. That signals to me, oh, great. They're not going to be in one day and gone the next. I'm not just a resume building opportunity for them. This is something I want to invest in this person because they're acknowledging that they're investing in me.
So how can people practice negotiating on a daily basis so that they can just crush it when they're in that high stakes negotiation, whether it's the job offer, they're buying a house?
Well, I mean, practice makes perfect. So if you have opportunities to spend time around children or babysit, that is a really good way to flex those muscles and start getting that muscle memory that practices your patience as well. I would say in non-COVID times, I would tell people go to the flea market and start negotiating for stuff in those kind of low risk circumstances. Go to a car dealership and start talking numbers with somebody. And even if you don't want a car, people are like, well, I don't want to waste people's time. You won't. If you had a great experience, you're going to recommend that person to somebody and they're going to get something out of it in the long term. I'd say call your telecom company, whomever it may be, and start renegotiating your current plan. I'm telling you, there's lots of opportunities for savings there all the time. You don't have to necessarily get more. You can actually get savings. So you don't have to necessarily go out and buy stuff. You can renegotiate existing stuff. But find those low-risk opportunities. And so can you find somebody with whom you can practice, like role play? What would it be like if I was buying a souvenir on a beach in Mexico from you? Or, you know, I'm negotiating a job offer. When I tell my students about job offers, it's role play, role play, role play. Practice. Say it out loud. Say it in front of a mirror. So when you are saying these words, it's not for the first time. And your mouth is comfortable actually spitting them out. Your brain is used to hearing them and is familiar with them. Those little things go a really, really long way.
I love that. That's great. And last question for you. What is one thing that you wish you had learned in school that you weren't taught?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I wish I was taught to manage my stress better because I'm a worrywart by nature. I'm an anxious personality. And so I feel like most of my adult working life has been about trying to determine stress management. But if someone had told us about stress management, how you need recovery, how you can't go through and even pull an all-nighter. Oh, I did a lot of all-nighters, but it's not the most effective way. It's you need to take breaks every so often. You need that recovery time for your brain. I wish those were the habits that I had much earlier on, that discipline for self-care, to make sure that I really maximized everything. We are piling on our expectations to the younger generation, and we are basically facing a reality where, you know, mortgages are much bigger, salaries are not bigger. We are dealing with so many more stressors. We're under a microscope of social media, and we need that resilience more than ever. And I feel like I learned it, though it could have been more efficient and more effective a lot earlier in my life. But my wish for so many younger people today is to learn that resilience a lot faster.
So tell everyone where they can find you and follow you and your book. Where can they get it when it's out in April?
So you can find lots of information at fotiniicon.com, which is my new website. You can find me at the same handle on Instagram, where I often take questions from my audiences, at fotiniicon. LinkedIn is a place where I post a lot of articles and things that are valuable, I think, to me, and then I hopefully share them out to others. And the book launches April 20th. You should be able to buy it anywhere books are sold. That's the expectation so far. But all of the information should be on my website again. Again, at fotiniicon.com.
We are so excited to read it. Amazing. And thank you so much for your time, Fotini. This has been amazing.
We hope that this episode inspires you to go after what you want and ask for what you deserve.
We'll leave you with a quote from our go-to motivational source, Oprah. You get in life what you have the courage to ask for.
That's what she said.
So there you have it, guys. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you heard today, it would mean the world to us if you would subscribe and leave a comment or a rating.
And we'd love it if you would share this with your friends by screenshotting the episode and sharing it on social by tagging at Teach Me How to Adult Podcast. And DM us with any topics or guests you'd like to hear on the show. See you next time. Bye!